right?
This is the 13th talk in the series. It's called Science, Technology, and the Aquarian Age. Now, when we left off last time, we spoke about regeneration in the Aquarian Age. We were relating Scorpio to Aquarius. And we came into that subject, which is the fall of humanity. And every time I come to that subject, there's always a lot of problems. The purpose of the talk was to look at spiritual regeneration. Spiritual regeneration from a place where we are way too absorbed with materialism. And that was, we talked about the materialism of the Aquarian Age with Taurus, and then we talked about the regeneration of that from Scorpio. But when doing that, we reviewed how we got into the fix where we became materialistic. We went into the Adam and Eve story and the fall of humanity, and how by directing the creative energy, the spinal force, too much downward and outward, we produced a materialism both for ourselves and in the world. We hardened the world, we hardened ourselves, and we got ourselves into quite a terrible fix. Now, when we talked the last time, we tried to talk about a new humanity, a humanity that was redeemed from materialism. And we tried to talk about the things that we have to do to redeem ourselves, or to be redeemed in the case of grace. And we saw that there were serious difficulties in reaching that new state, whether by works or by grace or by both, that there were things that we had to change our attitudes about. But apparently what happens is that most people don't focus on the positive new humanity. And many people have a lot of problem dealing with the whole idea of the fall, that there is even a fall. And early in life, I was quite surprised by all of that. But as time has gone on, and I've seen this phenomenon happen again and again, there's something fascinating about the concept of sin, that people become both attracted to it and repulsed by it at the same time, and they become very preoccupied with it. Over the course of years, I have participated in a number of study groups in which we have read the Rosicrucian Cosmo Conception. And I no longer do that. And I no longer do that for several reasons, because I find that that prayer unifies people, whereas discussion and difference of opinion or difference of ways of getting at things tends to divide people. And usually, with many people, the divisiveness of discussion is stronger than the attraction of prayer. I'm not snobbish about it, because it isn't a matter of the intellectual capacity, because that's not what you look for in a spiritual discussion anyway. You look for originality from people's own experience of the matter. But I just don't like to participate in those groups. At one time, there was a group here in town, one of the times that they formed, and it was a straight reading through the Cosmo Conception. It was a slow, steady progress, page by page, paragraph by paragraph, and article by article. But when they got to the part of studying the fall of humanity, once that subject of sin and evil and all of the things we call by that name, it was as if everybody just forgot about what they were doing. And you hear all, when that happens, it happens with many different people. You hear all kinds of articles, all kinds of statements made, like Max Heindel can't be true because he didn't focus enough and tell us enough about evil. I've heard this. I've heard this on several occasions. They didn't tell us enough of the different forms and forces of evil that there are. Well, this is for spiritual growth, and it's not for the not the study of evil. But in this little group, it was a matter that no progress could be made at all. Instead of page by page, it became word by word, and it eventually stopped down the whole group altogether. One of those kinds of things. So the subject that we dealt with last time and that carries into the talk this time is of that nature. It talks about that subject, and I hope that we don't get stuck in that again. Now, in astrology, there are what are called a greater and a lesser benefic. Jupiter being the greater benefic and Venus being the lesser benefic. There are also a greater and lesser malefic. And the greater malefic is Saturn, and it is associated with the sins of omission. Mars is the lesser malefic, and it's associated with the sins of commission. Now, since probably all of us that are in this study or in these talks were children of fire, and being children of fire, we tend, when we make errors, more toward the direction of commissive sins. We are the children of the fiery Mars, and we tend to do that. Even if we're careful, after having made a lot of mistakes, we get like Mars. We get cocky, and when we get overconfident, there we fall all over again. We think we're going to make it. We're going to climb up that difficult slope of generation, but we count our chickens before they're hatched. Chickens and eggs, of course, being associated with Mars and Aries. This is, by the way, is the Mars talk, so it'll take a long time for us to realize that. So in our overconfidence, we overstep. And as people of the sins commission, we almost all think we know more than we really do. The children of fire are not people who are given to humility very easily. So I guess I shouldn't be surprised that this kind of thing comes up. I shouldn't be discouraged, and I no longer am discouraged, because I have realized it in myself. There have been so many days that I have said, well, today is going to be the perfect day, and I'm going to put all of my focus of attention on truth, beauty, and goodness, and I'm going to be a thoroughly loving person, and then something comes along and I don't do it. There's always some kind of a fool or an adversary or an enemy or a heretic or a bad driver or an impertinent clerk or a cop, or someone gets in the way so that you can't see the light, so that we can't stand between us and Christ. And it's very difficult to see the face of Christ in their being. And that always comes up, and then I fall. It happens to me quite frequently, usually every day. But when I've watched friends for a long time who aspire on the spiritual path, none of them is perfect. All of them have had their transgressions and their regressions. All of them have fallen in little ways and sometimes in big ways. But But it's really good to see that once the spiritual life has taken hold in someone's consciousness, they don't give up. And so over the years of watching people with this same struggle, it almost seems as when they've fallen, they seem to strive harder rather than less. So we shouldn't be discouraged, and we shouldn't let the subject material that we talked about last time get us down. Now, this doesn't mean that we are going to stay in the fall. It just means that there is hope, there is promise that we can come out of it. We're going to talk some more about the fall a little bit, and we hope that it isn't merely vain repetition, because the spiritual things are such that we can look at them again and again, and if we look at them as being new each time, we discover something new in them each time, and it isn't just a vain, rote, automatic repetition. So, since I can talk like an Aries tonight, I try to live within these signs as I give the talks, and so I can talk like an Aries tonight, and since I'm doing the talking, I get to pick the topics, and I get to choose what is relevant, and I get to choose what I like to talk about. So what I'm going to talk about is something that is, one part of it is, one item is in the third chapter of Genesis, and the other item is in the fourth chapter of Genesis. And they are things that I have never understood well, and even after putting together these thoughts for this talk, I still don't understand them really well, but I have a better understanding of them, at least in relation to what we're going to try to talk about tonight. I think that the things that are mentioned in the third and fourth chapter of Genesis are related to each other in that they have to do with the first and second sins, the sins of Adam and the sins of Cain, which we know in the modern world as the sins of sex and violence. Now, the thought form or the thoughts that I'm trying to use tonight are far from mature. So what we're going to do is we're going to be doing a little bit of exploration. And we won't be quite so authoritative about things. In the second chapter of Genesis, Adam and Eve are naked and unashamed. They're naked and unashamed. That's in the second chapter. In chapter 3, they eat the fruit, and their eyes are opened, and immediately they see their bodies, and they sew fig leaves, and before long, Jehovah is making them skins to cover themselves, which is interesting because it involves the death of animals to get the skins, whether you kill them or hopefully you don't, whether they die. In fact, if you look in the early chapters of Genesis, we are told to be vegetarians. We're told to eat only of the herbs. But it isn't until after the fall that meat is incorporated into the diet. In chapter 4, Jehovah shows a preference for the gift of Abel over the gift of Cain. And it seems that Jehovah apparently has respect for the shepherds, but not for croppers, gardeners like you and I, Ken. We are on the bad list. Now this is very curious, and it's certainly figurative, and it must mean something more than just simple things. So we are going to look at these ideas, but as we look at them, I must warn you that the way we look at them is going to be somewhat biased. I am a child of fire. I am one of the children of Cain, and I see things from that point of view, and it doesn't have to be a bad way of looking at things. There are many virtues to the way of looking at things from the viewpoint of fire. The only thing is that when you look with a viewpoint, it is a viewpoint. And until each of us, myself included, has the Christ-like consciousness that I can see everything without bias, there's always a likelihood that there will be bias and there will be no distortion. I'm not going to try and flaunt the idea of the firelings or anything like that, but I won't be shy about it either. And I won't exaggerate it to distortion. Now, one has to discriminate between bias and ideas and between bias and fact. The ideas and the facts are like the substance of the soup, whereas the bias or the individual outlook is like the seasoning, and we season according to taste. Now, Max Heindel, when he wrote from cosmic fact. But when he did so, he said, it's still likely to bias because I'm interpreting it. I have an individual point of view, and that automatically indicates a bias. So I'm not even a seer as Max Heindel was a seer, so all I'm working from is thought and intuition. So let's go back to what we're looking at. We're saying that in chapter 3, they eat the fruit, their eyes are open, and immediately they see their bodies, and they are ashamed, and they stole fig leaves, and eventually Jehovah makes coats of skins for them. And in the fourth chapter, Jehovah shows the preference for the gift of Abel that is from the sheep rather than the produce from Cain. All right, that's where we are. I'm going to way back in the notes. Now, it seems that these two passages are two viewpoints and two issues which are each separate issue. The two viewpoints involved in them are the viewpoints of Jehovah, the divine being, and the viewpoints of the humans, that is, Adam and Eve, or Abel and Cain. The issues are the issues of nakedness and the issue of being a cropper or a cropping. Now, there are a lot of fascinating things about these two passages, but it would get awfully long if we follow all the things of fascination, so we're going to pass on most of them and reduce it right down to the simplest things that we are trying to get to the Aquarian age. Now, when we do that, there's always a danger of eliminating something that is essential and not getting at something which is a necessary view of the truth, but I don't think it is that kind of omission. Nakedness might not even be the central issue at all. If we think about being naked, it wasn't an issue before they ate the fruit and got the knowledge of good and evil. Their being naked wasn't an issue beforehand. Why should it be afterward? If Adam hadn't spilled the beans, Jehovah might not even have known that they were naked. Jehovah, being the highest initiate of the angels, didn't have eyes. And so he couldn't see the external nakedness the way Adam and Eve could. What is most likely in all of this is the disobedience. The disobedience at eating the fruit. Now, Jehovah is certainly the chief of the children of water. He is the highest initiate of the angels, and therefore the angels are associated with water and life and all of the things that grow in life. that are regulated by the moon, and so he certainly has to have the watery point of view. And the children of water do not like disobedience. Clothing was also an issue. It's also hard to figure out. Nakedness should not be any kind of a big deal. We see naked animals all the time. And if the statements given by the mysteries that our bodies were more animal-like at that time than they are now in the human form, it would have been no big deal for us to be naked. The way they're described in the writings of Max Heindel is they're described as being something like we see tarsiers or lemures from the island of Madagascar. That's the way he describes them, both in size and in shape and in the development of this and development of eyes. Probably what was at issue was the desire for naked bodies. That desire having been acquired through indulgence. When we're talking about stories like the Adam and Eve story, it's not like it all transpires in one diurnal day like a day like today. We're talking about something that transpires over thousands of years. And by the time that we're speaking of here, the self-indulgence probably had a pretty good hold on them. Our innocence had been lost, and we began to see the body as something desirable, something that we would like to possess. Because we were insecure, we were incomplete, and what we are insecure about and what we desire is often what we try to possess. Possessiveness and materialism, and that all goes together. It isn't just for things. It's all together about life. When we begin to experience spiritual things, and we see that they have an irresistible value, the baser desires become replaced. Sexual desire, sexual experience, even though it is a powerful desire and a far powerful experience, are greatly overrated. If we have even one little spiritual experience, we know very clearly that what's the big deal about sex. And I think it is very, very important that we express this fact often, because it is a conspiracy. This is the satanic side. Don't say anything. Don't say that you find sex to be as not the be-all, end-all that the world makes it out to be. There are things like conspiracy jokes. A conspiracy joke is if all of us were to agree that when I said, dollop mushroom, that everybody would laugh. And then somebody new comes walking in the room, and then I start telling the story, and then I say, and dollop mushroom, and then everybody would laugh, and then you watch that other person. That's what's called a conspiracy joke. The person doesn't know what to do, and it's interesting to watch all of the expressions that pass across the face. What finally happens is the person to be sociable laughs along. And most people, with regard to sexual experience, go along with the idea that it must be something great, even if it isn't that great to them, and you expose the whole conspiracy every time that you put forward that, you know, this is what it is, it is no more than this. So it must be have something to do with the nakedness. And so we're talking about nakedness and the lack of clothing as in relation to the loss of innocence and to desire. Now, our outer eyes were open when we ate the fruit. That saying, this happened at the same time in time, that as we came into our body more through more sexual activity, which it had a partially benign effect, that we began to see through our senses more, and that literally our eyes were open and we could see things outside of us. But coetaneous with that was a loss of inner vision, so that as we became outwardly more aware, we became inwardly unaware. So when we were opening our eyes, we were missing something, and we felt that we really were missing something important. What we did is we projected it. We projected our insecurity at losing the glories of the spiritual worlds, which is what the Garden of Eden represents. It represents the kind of plant that we used to have that came naturally to us. The loss of that something missing, we projected outward onto nakedness. And it must be because of that nakedness outside there that we feel incomplete. There must be something wrong with that. It was a realization that there was something wrong, but it didn't really sink into our consciousness. So this is a different kind of a shame than just a mere shame of how the physical body looks or doesn't look, whether it's beautiful or not beautiful. This almost sounds like a sermon more than it does, a Kabbalistic sermon more. Like the thought on the Aquarian Age. Clothing the body was an outward attempt to cover up shame, because that's what our life has become. Our life has been a cover-up. We try to hide things. We try to hide our selfish desire. And so that's what clothing represents. Turns out that it doesn't work, because the same desire that made us possessive of other people's bodies instead of taking them naturally, that same desire has been transplanted to clothing. And clothing has provocative values, and the people who want to continue on with that luciferic consciousness put it into the clothing. But it was more than that. It was that attempt to supplement an inadequacy, incompleteness of which we were becoming self-conscious. The more we were cut off from the spiritual worlds, the more we felt inadequate, and the more we sought something outside of us. And the way we supplemented that, at least those of us who are primarily children of fire, was through works, through Luciferian works. Now, some works, if they're done with the exclusion of faith, turn out to be detrimental, and they only tend to bring us deeper into matter. That's the way our vanity works, and that's a lot of what is happening, is we become more and more with our works, and not the purpose of those works, we become more and more materialistic. Works and deeds are something that have always been present in the struggle between the children of fire and water. It carries right into the New Testament, where the disciples fought over faith and works, faith being a watery principle and works being a fiery principle. The tilling of the soil that Cain did, which contrasted with the picking of the fruit in the garden that was there, that grew on the tree of life, was a self-reliant deed. And that self-reliance is what Jehovah, being with the children of water, who wants authoritarianism and appeal to power and obedience, didn't want, and he didn't respect, and even felt that it was a punishment. That was the punishment, was, but when you're cast out of the garden, you're going to have to learn by the sweat of your brow, and that means works. But works is how we progress, and so what I'm trying to say is that there is an attitude in the Bible, a Jehovistic attitude in the Bible about the question of works. We're talking about deeds, and that means means to do things, tools and devices, infernal machines if you are of the children of water. But we're talking about the subject of tonight's talk, which is technology and the science that produces it. In passing, before we move on, the clothing of Adam and Eve by Jehovah seems to have been a protective act. A protective act, just as you would expect from the highest of all the children of water. Now, we have said almost nothing about the difference of the viewpoint between Jehovah and the humans in the story. That difference is best elucidated and very clearly elucidated by the astrological mandala. This is the first of the two sextile talks, the talks that relate Aries and Sagittarius to Aquarius in the Aquarian age. Now, the basis of the sextile aspect in astrology is different than the basis of all other aspect relationships that are implicit in the structure of the mandala. The conjunction and the opposition are non-geometric figures. The conjunction is a point, and the opposition is a line. And those aren't figures. Those are locations. The trine and the square are simple, equilateral, geometric figures. In fact, there are only three equilateral geometric figures that are simple that you can inscribe in a circle. They are the trine, the square, and the pentagon. Those are the only three that you can produce, and they can all be produced with just a straight edge and a compass. The sextile is based on the equilateral hexagon, and it is a compound geometric figure. If we take the symbol of the sextile, that is the symbol of the sextile. What it really is skeleton or the bones of the components of an equilateral hexagon. So we're talking here about the first compound figure, or the least number of sides that is a compound figure that fits into a circle. Now, if we remove the lines of construction that are the skeleton, we have the Star of David, Seal of Solomon, which all schools of mysticism recognize as the symbol of the macrocosm. So when we're talking about the sextile, we're looking at a triangular reflection of microcosmic, macrocosmic, or universal scope. Now, in the triangle, the big process, the evolutionary creation of which we are part, There are three parts in that. There is the materialization of spirit, which is called involution. There is the spiritualization of matter, which is called evolution. And there is the evolution of consciousness, which takes place through the revolutionary experience of involution and evolution, where spirit interacts with matter. The downward pointing triangle is spirit descending into matter. The upward pointing triangle is matter rising up to spirit. The whole process is focused through an individual center, and that is what produces the center of consciousness in our being, through which everything is experienced. When we place this figure on the mandala, unfortunately I don't have that part of the mandala finished yet, we see that the lines of construction are between the cusp of Cancer and Capricorn and the cusps of the earthy signs, first cusps of the earthy signs. So we see that the triangle pointing upward is earthy in nature, and the triangle pointing downward is watery in nature. The triangle pointing down is the viewpoint of Jehovah, and the triangle pointing up is the human perspective in relation to the divine union. So we're looking at the two perspectives, the perspective of Jehovah versus the perspective of Adam and Eve and Abel and Cain. So in all of this, we understand that when we're looking at the grand sextile, we're looking at the basic crystalline structure of spirit evolving in matter and matter being spiritualized into spirit. It's the most basic structure of that process. The connecting oppositions represent the inverting connections. That's the way the opposition always works. It's never what you had expected it to be. It's always the opposite, and it seems to come at you from nowhere. And the way these things work in spiritual things is that the higher spiritual things get reflected into the lower material bodies, so that the deepest aspect of the spirit is reflectively projected into the deepest aspect of physical matter, that is the dense physical body, whereas the life spirit is reflectively projected into the etheric body, and the desire and the life and the human spirit reflected into the desire body. Now, the opposition shows the demand of matter. It isn't a demand like a boss has a demand that says, you've got to do this. That would be from the other end. It's a demand like a computer is a demand. If you are programming for a computer, the computer is utterly stupid. And if you don't tell it every little thing to do, it just stops dead. It demands our attention continuously. If we let our attention drop, everything is lost. And that is the demand of matter that I'm trying to get at here. I'm very lost in my notes. Saturn, in the Saturn period, the dense physical experience and the resistance of holding together forms, that kind of stubbornness that we learned in the Saturn period, projected in the opposite being the will, the power of will that in the withstand any kind of resistance to it. I can command anything that happens. Now you can see in a similar way that there is a correspondence between each of our vehicles and an attribute of the Spirit. We don't need to go into that because everybody has spent some time thinking about that. Now, we find the deepest attribute of the Spirit focusing into the deepest part of the mandala. The divine triangle is on the cusps of the watery signs, so from the viewpoint of Spirit, including the viewpoint of Jehovah, the process is a subjectifying process, drawing it into the universal subjective, not in a pejorative sense. And the nadir point of the mandala, the cusp of Cancer, is the most subjective place in the entire mandala. On the mandala, it is also the point of the summer solstice, when the material work is the strongest. So the Spirit is there for us to work against the greatest materialization at that time. Now there's a whole lot of this that we could go into, but there just isn't time. And if I did that, it would rob you of the joy of making discoveries about the same thing. Now, the divine triangle, the down-pointing triangle, which is not so much our business, but in this case, the business of Jehovah, the third of the threefold Spirit. The other triangle, the earth triangle pointing up, is our business. In this figure, human aspiration reaches up to the Spirit. It's aspiration that reaches as high as it can go. It's breathless. It's like the feeling at winter solstice, when you're filled with the Spirit of giving and giving and giving, and you give as much as you can, and that's as high as you can go. But the mandala, as we know it now, shows clearly that that aspiration is blinded in matter. It's blinded in earth. We see that happen. That's when the store sell everything, and for some people, Christmas is all about presents and material things. And it's grounded in matter, which is opaque, which is dense and which we can't see through. Our understandings are now reflections. They're only intimations because of our material darkness. When we're charged from the luciferic fiery signs, and we reach the earthy signs which follow after, we have all of our aspirations, all of our drives to accomplish things get blunted by materialism. We become so focused in materialism because of this habit. You might say that it wasn't the original act, which probably took many tens of thousands of years to become preoccupied with the sexual creative force, both in magic and in other ways that we have used it for personal pleasure, that habit of putting our evaluation in matter as a replacement for the spiritual understanding that we lost in the fall is, you know, it's our first way of looking at things. Now, material science forms the basis of our technology. Forms the basis of our deeds and works, which is why there are statements in the Bible like the poor you have with you always, meaning to say that not that we shouldn't take care of the poor, but that we shouldn't so much think about poverty as the attitudes that produce poverty and the lack of spirit behind those kinds of attitudes. All of our progress in science and is for in large driven by selfishness. Our outlook about the nature of reality from material science is that there are blind laws of nature and that there is a blind evolution with no purpose and no internal guidance and no creativity. And of that, we're supposed to believe that intelligence, self-conscious awareness, comes out of something that is completely blind, completely meaningless. It's a very stark framework. There is no apperception of truth in the determined laws. If we reduce it even further, we would see that some kind of chance occurrence would completely change the truth. I read science magazines, and there are magazines that have articles like that. They say, wow, it's just a fantastic lucky thing of chance that things combined produce the world as we know it now. If one constant were changed by one little point, it wouldn't be there. And they think this is all chance, that it isn't something, that this isn't something true. Not realizing when they say that, that their knowledge is equally meaningless. And their knowledge is equally chancy. If a cosmic ray event occurred and it went through their brain at a moment, they might think something is true because of that experience, and not necessarily that there is an object of truth and that we are truth knowers that are tuned into the same universal truth. That matter, having had a different breakfast or having a different set of parents, would have resulted in a totally different science. It's not like there is an objective, like that there is a reality, that there is a universal truth that connects it all together. You don't get truth out of blind ignorance. There have to be truth knowers. The truth has to have existed there before. And the people who are truth knowers, which we are from time to time when we're very lucky, we could only become truth knowers if we have that potential of truth in ourselves in the first place. It isn't an exact, it isn't an accident that someone turns out to be a great scientist or a logician or a philosopher. It's really strange the way it works, because a lot of these people are really proud of their intelligence and of their accomplishments, and if they realize that it's just a product of blind chance and laws of nature, what do they have to be so proud of? They really haven't developed anything. Now, because the fundamental understandings have been skewed by the satanic and luciferic taint, the commission and omission, there is a price to all of this. The material blindness is satanic in nature. We think we can hide things. And the emergency with which we approach everything is luciferic. The whole idea that we could just rush forward and dispose, well, maybe I better not go off into a side trip. The whole idea of disposability, instead of looking at things as cycles or spiral cycles within an integrated whole, is a luciferic idea. I can just throw this beer can out of the window. It doesn't make any difference. And it's that kind of attitude, because there is not a realization of connectivity of everything in truth, of everyone in spirit, in life spirit. We come up with these kinds of outlooks. And these are the things that we have to not allow ourselves to fall into if we want to progress forward. So we try to dispose of things, either enemies like insects or things like that, and we poison ourselves. And we produce devices, and we produce substances with addictive escapist tendencies. It's not only that we're ashamed of the nudity and we try to cover it up with clothing or whatever things we try to cover it up, we try to escape with it, from it with drugs and things of that nature. So we have the same misdirected illusions that the Lucifers intended for us. We keep making more and more progress by sex and violence. It's all Luciferian progress, and the Lucifer spirits like that we don't see things clearly. They like that we are skewed into materialism, because if we could see through all of that and recognize the unified truth to things, the game would be up for them. We wouldn't follow into those ways which are, you know, like food that has no nourishment. You can eat and eat and eat, and it may taste good, but there's no nourishment to it. So if we once see the unity, which is our duty to bring forth to people, that's the end of that. We have the misdirected illusions that we were intended to have. And these are, some of them are pretty subtle, but when you look at them, they're silly. For example, technology, take television. At one time, people believed that all of the problems of the world would be solved by technology. They believed, for example, that the dishonesty in politics would be solved by the television, because you could see a candidate on the television screen and you could know when he was lying. Didn't work. All we did is produce more sophisticated liars. Now we think that communication is totally facilitated by the internet and by cell phones, and we have all these people that are supposedly communicating with each other, and what they really are is they're very, very lonely, and they're not saying anything significant to each other. In fact, I've never heard anybody yabbering over a cell phone that really told somebody on the other end that they love them. And so we have all these people that are jabbering on the internet, and they think that this is communication. Do you tweet? I don't. the whole idea is almost funny to me. Now, this isn't saying that science and technology are bad or evil or anything like that, because to say that would be wrong. It would be a sin worse than the first sin, because there would be no new actions and there would be no new soul power that would come out of those actions. It's not the science and technology per se, but how we go about science and technology, what our interactions are with each other, and what is the integrity of our deeds. That has to be within science and technology. It's easy to hide behind a computer screen and not be forthcoming about who you are and not be honest about all things. All of these problems that we've just mentioned, pollution and things like that, could be solved by technology. There are ways even that we could destroy radioactive nuclear waste. But it always comes down to saying it would cost too much. Well, if human life and having a concern for everything that's living and evolving is dispensable, and if it costs too much, you know, where are our values, you know? We're lying to ourselves. We have these wrong kinds of values, and we're told openly in St. Matthew's, in the Old Testament, the sin against the Holy Ghost is implied as abuse of the sexual function. In St. Matthew's Gospel, we're told literally by the biblical Christ that the sin against the Holy Gospel, Holy Ghost, is lying. At the other end of the spinal fire. And so what we're talking about is how the same creative principle, the same creative attitudes are not just merely sensual things. They are the lying and the false values that we have applied to spiritual energy to. Which is the way that the Lucifers gain experience through our reveling in excitement, in emergency, and that is how they grow and how they further their own evolution, at least for the while. Christ didn't teach science and technology. He could have, and he even declined anything in that direction. Now, in the Lemurian epoch, we jumped the gun with creativity, and we got our entire nature out of balance, and we're morally incapable, it seems, of abstaining. We can't abstain from things. The imbalance is an imbalance that our moral nature is out of harmony with the advancement of our intellectual and desire nature. We build bombs that we can't not use. We have all sorts of things, but we don't seem to be working as hard on our moral and ethical development as we are on technical development. This is what we're talking about. We're trying to talk about appropriate technology. This applies to us as spiritual students especially, because with our knowledge, we're capable of horrendous abuse. This is why at the center of all our aspiration, we have the exercises that help to purge us from our moral, ethical deviations and to cleanse us from our overweening desires, whether they be commissive or omissive. If we don't heed any of these things, and if we don't respect each other, we, like in our Rosicrucian Fellowship, we could destroy each other over petty church politics rather than just thinking about loving as much as we can and working together however we can. All right, that's the end of the ranting and raving part. You can only do so much of that. To repeat, our understandings now are reflective imitations. However, not all of the reflections on the mandala come through the opposition aspect. Some come through the principle of the sextile, which is what we're trying to get at. The adjacent points on the two triangles are sextiles. That's what we're sextiles indicate, reflective consciousness, but without the deadlocking opposition. They are reflective reflections into a new element, which means a new kind of experience or looking at things in a new way. It gives you a bigger perspective. And that bigger perspective is a perspective that is closer to the perspective of the universal spirit. So there is a very broadening versatility in the sextile that introduces us to new things, and it introduces us in new ways, in a complementary manner. There is a reflection, but a complementary reflection. Moreover, since the sextile figure represents the macrocosm, there is for us a broadening from the dark material perspective into the softer, the more illumined spiritual perspective. This is broadening and reflecting and expanding in the greatest sense, as when we talk of a great person or of a big man or a big woman. We'll come back to this in a minute, but we have to go on to something else. Let's return to our part of the work, and that is the earth triangle pointing up. Even here, there is frustration for the speaker, because we haven't even glanced at the surface of this subject, and we have have to now move on to something else. That's one of the things with giving talks like this, you discover things. It's sort of like if you're in Carlsbad Caverns or someplace like that, you walk along and suddenly discover there's a whole corridor down there of other places that you could go. And they're all wonderful, and they have different things for the imagination to feast on. But before passing on, let's look at one other point that seems to be important. Saturn is at the top of the Earth triangle, and Saturn represents time, Capricorn. To some extent, we didn't know time until we knew matter. By matter, we mean anything concrete. The concrete worlds are the worlds of time. The transcendent worlds, especially the transcendent worlds of pure spirit, are the realms of eternity. Now, it's a funny thing that all of our time is measured in terms of space and of matter. So there is an inseparable relationship time with space and matter, whereas a potential, it is filled with spirit. The other triangle points downward. It points to Cancer, which represents space. Space in the sense of a womb of the spirit. So we see time, space, in the vertical, the spirit-matter pool, as the basis of the grand sextile as it appears in the standard position on the mandala. The vertex is, as we have seen, connected by an opposition. So there are oppositional paradoxes of both time and space, spirit and matter, intention and extension. Let's look at a paradox of time. And that is, in all of this, because we jumped the gun, that is, we committed, we followed the Luciferic martial quality, and we jumped ahead of time, because of that, it takes us longer. It's one of those ironies of time and space. The opposition, we said earlier, always gives the opposite of what we expect. In this case, it is so that when we jumped the gun, we focused in a specializing way, in that Saturnine materialistic specializing way, and we became ignorant of the greater cosmos and working in harmony with it and having healthy, positive cycles of experience. Like science and technology, specialized, concentrated material consciousness is not wrong, but it is the motivation, selfishness. We were going to buy ourselves eternity, or so we thought with the part that was omitted. We weren't told about the acting adharmoniously with what was going on, which was basically an omission. Try to get at this in another way, and that means telling a story. It's a story from probably one of the best all-time storytellers in history, someone who made up allegorical stories almost at the drop of a hat, and they were beautifully conceived. And it is from Plato, who was one of the best storytellers, and this happens to be the allegory of the cave, which I'm sure most people are familiar with. The story was told to people so that by analogy they could see just how blinded and deluded they were by materialism. Now, Plato was oriental in some of his thinking, in that he thought that matter was an illusion. Not illusory, but thought it was an illusion. And this was because he had deep spiritual experience, and the nature of deeper spiritual experience is that it has the character of being more real or feeling more real. The same way that the materialist feels that because you can stub your toe on a stone, that indicates true reality. Someone like Plato, who could see the universal ideas as they issued from the realm of pure truth, which we would call the life spirit, because he had that, he recognized that that was reality, and comparatively speaking, he thought this world was illusion. I hope he's been cured of that by now, but that's the way progress goes. Even great people make great mistakes. This is a story of people who are imprisoned in a cave. And it's something like this. There are people that are chained to this wall. And all they can see is this wall. This is the opening to the cave. And the sun shines in, and they think light is only the reflected light of the cave wall. They see people walking along up here, and they take the shadows as the reality. And I don't remember the story exactly. I think somebody escapes, and he gets out. And he sees the sun, and he sees the sunlight, and he comes back, and he tells them. And they don't believe him. They believe these are the realities, that the shadows are the realities. And something like that is what our consciousness has come to be like. Ironically, materialistic philosophers, even those of great intelligence, don't get the point when he's saying it. They say, well, this is a lovely allegory, but they think he has a superstitious, mystical view about what truth and reality are. He was a great storyteller, but as great of a storyteller as he was biased by his own insight. He didn't like painting, for example. He didn't like painting because he thought these bodies of ours are like the shadows on the wall. They are illusions, and that the real people can only be seen in spirit. And he says, if somebody makes a painting of someone else, you're making an illusion of an illusion, which shows how little from his way of thinking, that's true. But there's so much more to art than that, and there's so much more to insight and seeing and all of that. But of course, he wasn't too big on sensory experience, and sensory experience is exceedingly important. So as brilliant as he was, and as much insight as he had, you know, he wasn't perfect. And we all grow and we all get better. Now, I have a friend who's at the University of Iowa, who is a molecular biologist. And he publishes successfully in experiments more than his colleagues do. And he tells them outright, I do this by intuition. I have this positive attitude about there being an answer to things and a truth to things, and I intuitively know what experiments will work and what will prove to be positive. We're finally getting to Aquarius. Saturn is punctilious. It's a data collector. It's an organizer. It shares the realm of science with Uranus, which is the intuitive insight person. Saturn in the Aquarius is the lower lightning stroke. It's the data master. The higher lightning stroke is Uranus. So now we're finally at Aquarius. However, to get more deeply into Aquarius, we have to again return to the mandala. Now, there are two ways that the double triangle can be placed on the cusps of the mandala. They're in the same way that this is one configuration of the sextile, there is another that is like this. We have looked at the one with the vertical. It puts the vertexes of the interlocking triangles between the earth and water, between the fire and earth signs. Now, when we look at the other one, we're looking at the horizontal. The first way we looked at it, it is centered on the solstices. The second one, with the where everything is centered on the horizontal, is focused on the equinoxes. So, with the second focused on the equinoxes, the cusps then fall on the earth, on the fire and air signs. And for Aquarius, that means the adjacent points on the sextile or the double trine is on the cusps of Aries and Sagittarius. This, believe it or not, is the Aries talk, in that we've been focusing on building and deeds instead of faith. We're talking about a life of action. Now, this certainly had a lot of bluster in it. That's what an Aries talk has to be about. It has to have some bluster and scolding and things like that. I didn't take anybody to task. I don't think that's my place. But we talked about the bluster that builds up when the fiery Aries energy is restrained and held back by the mud of fire and water. That's where there had to be all of this scolding. Now, these talks are meant to be experiential. They're meant to put our consciousness into the sign that we're looking at relative to Aquarius so that we can really feel the spiritual environment that we are in. We very rarely are aware spiritual effects, the astrological effects that surround us. We know when we're around somebody who's angry, and sometimes we can feel that we're with some really strange person. Sometimes we can feel something like Christmas or Easter or something like that, but for the most part, there are all kinds of changes happening every day, but they are so subtle that we miss them. And then we wonder why we aren't clairvoyant. It's because we haven't been in touch with these spiritual forces. So in these talks, we're trying to be cognizant of the nature of Aries or of the nature of Sagittarius as we give the talk. The vertical pole is the hierarchical pole. It is the pole of stratification, of elites, of hierarchy. And that's just what we expect with water and earth and the watery children of water. The horizontal orientation likes equality, especially the ultimate vertex, zodiacally speaking, moving forward in the zodiacs, is Aquarius, where there is parallelism and equality and altruism and everybody is everybody else's friend. Aries, like the grasshopper, does leap before it looks. Aquarius leaps, but it suspends. It stays in heaven. Aries does have first-hand experience, even if that experience is science. And it's right at the frontier. For Aries, everything has to be hands-on. I don't want somebody telling me truth is, I want to experience it myself. Even if it's preemptive and energy-oriented, more than oriented toward matter and toward facts or things like that, it wants to be part of the cause, not part of the effect. So we already feel what it is like with the energetic positive signs. We we can clearly get the feeling of Aries and Aquarius in the idea of sublimation and rapid expansion, which is explosion. That combination of Aries, Aquarius, great fireworks lovers. They like that explosive kind of quality. Now, we don't want to spend too much time on these simple kind of relationships, so let's try to get something of a more universal understanding via the mandala, or else this might become just a practical astrology talk. The basic pole is the horizontal pole on the mandala. It runs between Aries and Libra. And it shows the most basic horizontal relationships. They are the I and thou relationship. It is the two of us together. Aries in the ascendant indicates a direct relationship with the world. Let me see for myself. Libra represents seeing the world through someone else's eyes. What kind of comfort, what does the other person need? So it is the basic introduction to two ways of looking at the world, each of which is equally important. Having my own opinion, having my own action, and seeing through other people. The air is focused in Libra, or Libra, or Libra, in the same way that the fire is focused in Aries. It's other-oriented, or sometimes it's culturally oriented. This otherness takes us outside of ourselves, the same way that a friend in trouble can cause us to forget our own situation and lead us to do things of bravery that we would never do. For the love of another, we do that. Carried to extreme, it is the ultimate otherness of the life spirit. It is the selflessness, or the definition of self in others, the universal other, which is what the altruistic love is made of. Ultimately, when the Aries doing things is through the Aries signs and the reflectiveness through Aquarius brought to its ultimate in that sextile relationship, it is literally doing something for the Christ's sake. So this gives us the spirit of expansiveness that we have been looking for all night. This cramping of the mud of fire, of water and earth. Now we can see the sextile expansiveness. Now let's take that spirit of expansiveness and see how Adam's apron of figs has evolved into expanding technology of our time so we can learn how to use them and use them to progress in our spiritual lives and to progress the whole or the collective other. Technology is here. We can't deny that fact. There are potential downsides to that, potential negatives, and there is always, when dealing with technology, the risk of falling into the hands of Lucifer if we are not aware of them. We're going to address only the positives, and we hope we're not going to address the positives with Luciferic overconfidence. We only have so much time left, so let's spend it looking at things more positive than what we have been looking at. Adam and Eve were told that they would have to work by the sweat of their brow. And we have. And we've worked mightily, and we've worked persistently. We can even move mountains. They do it in China. They cut mountains down with chainsaws. You know that? And that's how they pave a lot of their highways. They do it with motor scooters and chainsaws. They cut out blocks, and they have a continuous run of motor scooters going back and forth, each with a block on the back, and that's the way they pave a lot of their highways. Fortunately, in doing all of this work, we have become wiser. And we even use laziness, which is the reflection of overweening egoism. And we have used that to make our lives better. We have more and more technology and less grunt labor. Now, some things like processed food isn't very good, but a lot of things of technology are. We learn, or in the process of developing technology, we used to learn how to carry something from the very beginning to the end. That developed a self-reliance in us, an artisanship. But lest we become too self-oriented, we needed to share technology with everyone. And so what happened is mass production came along. And some people think that the idea of mass production is demeaning, where a person only does one thing and specializes in one thing. There's a positive side to mass production, and that is if you carry something all the way from the beginning to end by yourself, there's a certain amount of pride in craftsmanship and the ability to do the things that you do. But if you have to rely on someone else to do their job, that's opening type of consciousness, so that in even things like assembly lines, we're learning to trust other people. It's the sign of a self-made person, somebody who is a rugged individualist, who has to always be on top of everything and do things only his way and doesn't trust other people. Robotics will probably take things a step further. Nanotechnology and things like that will carry things even further. But with the technology, we have to learn to shift our consciousness according to what we have learned by the technology rather than becoming the prisoner of the technology itself. The television is a wonderful thing, as is the computer. Get a very fine education through watching television or working with the computer. But what happens is we can also put ourselves into that again, escaping from the nakedness, escaping into the fantasy world of television. And we are not going forward when we do something like that. What we learn, probably the person who builds the television, designs it or who discovered it in the first place is the one who really gets the most out of the television because that person understands the principle. Or the actors who put on the shows are getting something from the television. But what I'm trying to say here with technology is that we learn something from technology, but then we take that information or that experience that we gain from technology and we internalize it and spiritualize it. This is what the spiritualization of matter is all about. We're going to have more and more idleness, and right now the tendency is to escape from idleness into indulgence and entertainment. Entertainment figures in terms of salaried people are extremely high paid. Athletes, singers, people like that who entertain us, and they can't entertain us for very long because we get bored quickly. We're full of ourselves, and you know something outside of ourselves like that can't entertain us. The thing is that if we work with the spiritualization of matter, what we learn from technology and technological experiences, even cultural experiences, internalize that and we live that in our consciousness. Ultimately, our work is not going to be grunt work at all. Our work is going to be in consciousness, because it is our consciousness that is going to cause the mineral kingdom that we are now manipulating technologically to become plant-like. And you can't do that through technology. You can only do that through consciousness. So the greater and greater amount of free time that we have should be spent more and more in material and in inner work. We should also apply what we learn from technology to our own consciousness. What is happening is we are removed. We have this notion that we are removed from nature and that we can do with it what we want, like poison it and then eventually poison ourselves. But in this removal, we enter into an empty abstraction. This is not a transcendence from nature. This is an escape from nature, which is, again, one of those things of escaping through illusion. What is happening is through technology, we have we can build photomultiplier tubes that are so accurate they can sense one photon. That accurate they are. But all of the perception is being externalized. It's all being done by the machines, which is good for the machines. But at the same time, we should ourselves be extending, not leaving it all to technology, we should be extending our own observations, our own faculties, so that we not only see things by the light reflected off of them, but that we see through them. So what we learn from technology, or what we accomplish through technology, is again something that we should find inside of ourselves. There is nothing that we can find in the world outside of us that is not inside of us. And if we are only fulfilling one side of the equation, it doesn't make any sense. We need to be internal to the degree that we are external. A lot of things in society using technology are forcing us into spiritual awakeness, like it's happening right now. The biggest crisis right now is the credit card crisis. It's one thing, you had to have a certain kind of consciousness to barter. You had to see whether that item looked good and whether your item that you were going to trade was, you know, whether it was a worthy deal. But you can't do everything by bartering. That's, again, trying to do without any technological advance at all. So we invented currency, coins and paper, and it was something that represented something else. It was artificial. It was symbolic. Again, you can make mistakes with that. You can print all kinds of money, and then you run in with inflation. But now, by technology, worth or value has become something completely invisible. We can't see. When you put a credit card down, you can't see what you're worth. Now, it's true, they do all this data mining, that they know everything of your buying history, and they know what you want and what you don't want, and they have a really good insight into your psychology so that they can sell you more. There's nothing wrong with that. They're taking advantage of people with that. But think of it. By the time the Aquarian Age is over, we're all going to have clairvoyance. And none of us is going to have any secrets. So that we can see that technology, that many of the things, even some of them that we don't like, are things that are advancing us toward Aquarian consciousness. If you don't have any secrets to protect, if you don't have put your fig leaf apron on, you're open for the world to see. Yes, I did zip my pants up. but you see what I'm trying to talk about in all of this. Technology is not a bad thing. and it is through technology that we are going to advance. But the final point that we want to make is that the technology has to be in proportion. It has to be something that is not with that Mars attitude of we can do whatever we want, and that we become techno-crazy and not responsible. We need to be self-forbearant. We need to develop technology that is good for everyone, that is good for everything, and not just something that satisfies self-indulgence. It would be silly to try and become Luddites and say that technology is going to go away and we can make it go away or something like that. That's silly. It's more a matter of self-discipline. You know, you can have all kinds of temptations around you if you have inner strength, if you have inner values, if you have self-discipline, if you can control yourself and maintain yourself. And it's very good to be in an environment with all kinds of temptations if you need to learn that. There is an individual personal thing, and that's what we're talking about when we're talking about the cusp of Aries, being sextile to the cusp of Aquarius. We're talking about individual responsibility. We're not talking about inaction. We're talking about action in which a person is completely self-conscious of what the results of his actions will be with regard to the whole. That's a very important thing. And this is why I think, as far as the Aquarian age is concerned, the appropriate technology movement has as its slogan what I think is the perfect kind of slogan. It says, think globally, which is Aquarius, but act locally. Locally right within your own being, which is Aries, the personality. So we can do wondrous transformations. We're even going to have to do, in order to clean up the mess that we made so that things can go on, we're going to have to do some wondrous things. So, instead of being Aries-like in having technology be a fad, it can be translated into creative novelty. Creative novelty as Revelation, the being that is to represent Christ says, behold, I make all things new.
Did you draw the two sextiles to the right side?
No. This is the solstitial sextile. This is the equinoctial sextile.